body may grow weary, I won't stop till I reach the other shore.
Yes, indeed. We ended up with a gospel number there from Balsam Range, Row by Row. But let me tell you about the other songs that you just heard there on the Black Diamond Show. Back at the beginning of the set, the Osborne Brothers and Red Allen gave us My Aching Heart from, I think, about 1956. And then from 2019, Dale Ann Bradley and Tina Adair gave us Oh Darlin', a single they released. And remember, that was originally by the O'Kanes. Yeah, great band. And as I said, the last thing in the set was a gospel number. Balsam Range's Row by Row. Hey everybody, I am Mando Richard, and I thank each and every one of you for having tuned in for all or part of today's Black Diamond Show. You can always drop me a note with a request or any comments. I am Mando Richard, M-A-N-D-O Richard, at either Yahoo or Gmail. This is episode 161. If you're interested in making a comment on today's show. Thanks everybody for having tuned in, and I'll see you next week on the radio.
WRCT Pittsburgh. Real vinyl.
Listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Check my math and follow along. 88.3 over 100 is not 0.883. We exponentiate. Euler's number raised to not 0.883 is 2.418. Multiply by 1,000 to result 2,418. Add 401. Result 2,819. Multiply 25. 5 by 9 is 45. 5 by 1 is 5, and 4 is 9. 5 by 8 is 40. 5 by 2 is 10, and 4 is 14. 20 by 9 is 180. 20 by 1 is 20, and 10 is 30. 20 by 8 is 160. 20 by 2 is 40, and 10 is 50. Sum 70,475. Add 404. 70879. Multiply 11. Result 779669. Add 20. 779,689. Divide 10. Result 776.89. Square root 88.3 WRCT.
Hello everybody, it's Charlotte. So for my show for Pandemonium, which is airing right now on WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM, I will be doing a little story time because I'm assuming that most people who are listening to WRCT right now, whether that's one person or five people, I'm just assuming that they're mostly adults, and adults without children, and usually adults without children don't read stories enough. And stories are really important, and I don't have anything really meaningful or important to say myself. So just join me for 30 minutes of nice stories. I've got this book called Tales of the Unexpected by Roald Dahl. Maybe I'll read a few stories out of this. Maybe read some essays later. We'll see where this day takes us. But yeah, I hope you enjoy. So I lied. I'm not going to read anything from Tales of the Unexpected. I already recorded one of the stories, but I just wasn't really into it. It wasn't very interesting. And in the fast-paced world of radio, you know, you have to have something really exciting. So I want to read to you some stories from this book we read in my extreme ethnography class at Carnegie Mellon. It's called Ordinary Affect by Kathleen Stewart, and it's basically a collection of vignettes that the author, Stewart, has written, and they are about everyday life and the unexpected. And anyways, I'm just going to read to you some of these stories. So this one is called First Date. She stops in at a cafe on a town square in Ohio. Two middle-aged people sit awkwardly together at the next table. A thin, blonde, carefully tanned woman is having a grapefruit while the heavy-set, pasty man is eating biscuits and gravy. It's an odd scene, clearly their first meeting. The woman is talking about her workout schedule and what she eats. She says she's not obsessive about it, but she likes to keep her body in shape. She pulls out bottles of vitamins and herbal supplements. I take two of these when I wake up. These are with meals. These in the afternoon. These are good for energy if I feel a little low. She takes out lotion and rubs them into her skin. He maintains a careful look of interest, but things don't seem to be going well for him. A few minutes later, she hears the grapefruit woman say to the biscuit man, "Of course, you'd have to lose 30 pounds. He's nodding. "Of course, oh, yes. He's looking down at his biscuits and gravy. His eyes wander around the table at a level well below the range of possible eye contact. Then he lowers his head over his plate and eats. She wonders how these two people found each other. This is before internet dating, so maybe they used personal ads in the local newspaper. Maybe they were the only two single, middle-aged people in the county. Whatever it was an experiment, just to see what would happen. And things were happening, all right, even though it was not so happening. Color theory. Face-to-face interactions and common encounters jump in a quick relay to floating sensibilities and the conditions of connection that link us. In Las Vegas in the late 1980s, a post office outpost shares an ad hoc storefront with a flower shop and a gift shop sparsely filled with eclectic, inexpensive ceramics. At noon, when the post office and store are closed for lunch, a color therapy group sometimes uses the space. In one meeting, a dozen people sit in a circle on gray metal folding chairs. One man is talking about a relationship problem that has something to do with the fact that he's a magenta. The people in the group respond with intricate discussions of the shades of color and color combinations that connect different personal energies and styles. Then a young woman begins to talk about a problem at work that stems from her being a yellow. Now alternative health practitioners and mystics advertise color therapy on the web. They used colored gemstones, candles, wands, prisms, light bulbs, water, fabric, bath treatments, and eyewear to balance the body's energy and stimulate healing. Each color has a vibrational frequency. Warm colors are stimulating, cool colors are calming, and a strong attraction to certain colors might signal a particular imbalance. You can play a game with color codes if you want to. Red is active, daring, passionate, and optimistic. Red people are courageous, confident, humanistic, strong-willed, spontaneous, honest, and extroverted. Purple is grand, idealistic, and sensitive, but may lack self-criticism and maturity. Purple people make good, inspirational leaders. They are kindly and just, humanitarian, self-sacrificing, visionary, creative, and strong mentally. Magenta is less aggressive and more spiritual than red, and also more practical than purple. Yellow is intellectual and communicative. Yellow people are good-humored, optimistic, confident, practical, and intellectual. You can imagine yourself through the model of one of the types, or against it. Maybe you'd like to be orange. Orange is more ambitious and self-sufficient than red, but lacks its warmth. It has the intelligence of yellow without its loftiness. Orange people are enthusiastic, happy, sociable, energetic, sporty, self-assured, and constructive. But then you might think you're actually probably closer to a green. And that's on a good day. Green is healing, sympathetic, steadfast, and restrained. Green people are understanding, self-controlled, adaptable, sympathetic, compassionate, humble, generous, nature-loving, and romantic. You might begin to piece together combinations of colors and blends, making things up. But the people who are really into color therapy don't read colors as symbols or codes. They're into the real surface qualities of colors and what they can do. They don't care what colors mean. They're fooling around with the forces that be to see what things are made of. They want to set things in alchemical motion. They're talking things over with like-minded people. You never know. I used to have a lot of problems with frameworks like these for capturing people's personalities, like color therapy or theory and the Myers-Briggs test and astrology, because I've had kind of rough experiences with this in my life. Like, I'm a Pisces woman, just full disclosure, and I've had experiences with people where they would kind of just straight up tell me, I don't want to be friends with you because of your astrological sign. And like, how could we judge each other based off this made-up framework of like personality? Like, there's no way that me being a Pisces actually says anything, correct? But people really take this stuff seriously, and I mean, there was the whole Indigo Children phenomenon where children were believed to be at like a higher level of consciousness or something because their auras were indigo, and in actuality their parents were just like narcissistic and didn't understand their children. I don't know why people love this stuff so much, but I feel like especially astrology these days is basically like a foundation for social communication, at least with a lot of people I know. Anyways, so what color are you? What's your astrological sign? What's your Myers-Briggs personality letters? Can we create a new framework of coming up with, like, I don't know, maybe we're different types of fish or something. This is getting kind of ridiculous. I'm going to read you the next story. This next story is called Just Do It. Meanwhile, down the street, at practically the very same moment that the color therapy group is meeting in the post office, a chemical factory explodes and blows up half the town of Henderson, Nevada. The FEMA hearings drag on for months. There's a testimony. Small businesses have been ruined by the blast. Unmarked trains carrying dangerous chemicals have been running along the edges of backyards where innocent children play. There's talk of secret big business operations supported by the federal government of callous disregard for future generations. She starts talking with the de facto leader of the small business owners. He feels slighted by FEMA. He and the others have confrontations with local politicians. There are sinister threats. There are fights. They're digging for dirt and finding plenty. Bob is devoting his life to the cause. He spends hundreds of dollars on long-distance phone calls every month. He organizes a campaign to unearth stories. The young man who was raising tarantulas and poisonous snakes in his apartment to pay for college and lost everything in the blast. The retired couple who came to the town looking for peace or something and who awoke that night to the sound of windows and glass doors smashing all over the house and the smell of gas. When Bob and the other small business owners get no satisfaction from the government, they decide to take things into their own hands. They come up with an idea to start over by building a chemical factory of their own. They already know plenty about manufacturing. This is America, and they can do anything. Someone says he knows an engineer who will work with them. Now they just need someone who knows something about chemicals. Okay, this thing is crazy to me. Just when the chemical factory explodes and you experience all of this loss and devastation, it would not be the first logical step in my mind to create a new chemical factory, but I guess I could see how it's this thing that must be replaced and they think they can do it better and in a safe way, but yeah, I was not expecting that. Anyways, I'll keep reading. Things keep getting worse. Bob is calling her every night. Then he's piecing together a conspiracy too big to talk about over the phone. She meets him in a church parking lot on the edge of town. The sunset is spectacular. Bob wants to tell her his life story, the big, beautiful, wild Nevada of his childhood, hunting and fishing in a pure land. His return years later to start his own business and raise his children right. Then the explosion, just when he was beginning to get on his feet again. It's getting dark. He's talking too much about himself. She says she's talked to other people who have experiences like his and think the way he does. This makes him mad, much to her surprise. He's an individual. There's no one in the world like him. He isn't like anything. He comes on to her. She gets out of there, but now she's anxious and her stomach is queasy. He keeps calling. She visits him once more, this time at his house with his wife and children. There's no furniture left in the house. They sit on the carpet in the empty living room and eat pizza out of the box. Everyone's very quiet. It's scary and depressing. There's something just a little bit off and terribly wrong. Now he's mumbling bitterly about things she can't quite hear, and then she half realizes his talk has become lewd and is directed at her. This can't be happening. The air goes out of the room. She stands up and starts moving towards the door. She thanks his now wide-eyed wife. She leaves the house. He calls only once more, a couple days later, to report on the progress of his case with FEMA. She's cool with him on the phone, not encouraging him to keep in touch, keeping her distance too late. This next one is called Traces. People are collecting found objects snatched off the literal or metaphorical side of the road. Things that have dropped out of the loop or have been left sagging somewhere are dragged home as if they are literal residues of past dreaming practices. The snatching practice mixes a longing for a real world or something with the consumer's little dream of spying a gem or tripping over a bargain. And in the mix, all kinds of other things are happening too. This little nugget of wisdom really resonated with me because I'm a person who loves to collect things that are just lying around. My room is full of trash, but that's beside the point. Anyways, I was at school the other day, and in the hallway there was a fax machine that had a free sign on it, and I instantly thought, I must take this home. How could somebody just be giving away a fully functioning fax machine? Of course, I didn't know that it was fully functioning, but I just had assumed so because, I don't know, it just seemed like the kind of thing that people stopped using and they need to get rid of it, but they don't have the heart to throw it away. And I think that this is a phenomenon that so often occurs. Things that are basically trash, but people can't bear to throw away. And either that's because they feel terrible about, you know, the state of our planet and they don't want to contribute to climate change and the accumulation of stuff in our landfills, or they think that it has some sort of value to it and maybe someone can make use of it. Well, regardless of whatever that was, or what was the case for this fax machine, I really wanted it. And I don't know, maybe something could be done with a fax machine. If I only had one friend, just one friend who could get a fax machine too, we could send each other faxes all the time, and this feels like a very novel idea. I have one friend that I like to send letters to, and even though letters are kind of a regular thing, they feel like such a novelty every time I send or receive one, even though it's been, you know, 5 or 6 years since we began this. And so I thought maybe this is just an expansion on how I can communicate with people I care about through fax machines. You know, I can send drawings instantly. But I don't have any friends with the fax machine, and so I don't know if this object would make any use on its own. At the same time, though, how could I let a treasure like this just go to waste? Collecting dust in the hallway, I'm pretty sure nobody else will pick it up. It's been there for 2 weeks now. And maybe I'll find more joy out of it than anyone or any landfill ever could, so is it my responsibility to take it? Speaking of having a house full of trash, or a room full of trash, I'm moving soon. And I'm currently living in this house that's been passed down from generation to generation of college students. So the lease has never really been completely reset. There's always been one person carrying it over from year to year for maybe the past 10, 15 years. So there's this giant accumulation of random things that you would assume a college student would pick up on the side of the road and bring into their home in our basement. And it's a scary basement. There's water everywhere. It smells a little weird. It's dank. It's dark. There's remnants of a Pittsburgh toilet. And there's just all of this stuff. There's a single boot, a few deflated basketballs, there are lots of suitcases, there are pillows, there are picture frames, there are soggy art materials, there's a sled, an IKEA bag. There's all kinds of stuff, and it will be a fantastic feat to clear all of it out before I have to change over to my next lease, because there's just so much stuff. But beyond the physical feat, it's just a crazy mental feat to be throwing away so much stuff all at once, even though it's not mine. It feels crazy to be contributing this much waste to the world. But it's stuff that's going to be in this world, whether it's in my house or in a landfill, so what difference does it make? Anyways, this is not really a story, but I guess, I don't know, somebody has to hear about it, so I'm telling all of you listening on the radio. I think it's time to switch gears. I've been talking about myself for a little too long, and by now probably nobody's listening anymore. So to start fresh, I picked up my book of essays by Joan Didion, and this one is called Holy Water. I'm from California, so this one, and I guess all of her work, is important to me. So I would like to share this with you today. Some of us who live in arid parts of the world think about water with a reverence others might find excessive. The water I will draw tomorrow from my tap in Malibu is today crossing the Mojave Desert from the Colorado River, and I like to think about exactly where the water is. The water I will drink tonight in a restaurant in Hollywood is by now well down the Los Angeles Aqueduct from the Owens River, and I also think about exactly where that water is. I particularly like to imagine it as it cascades down the 45-degree stone steps that aerate Owens water after its airless passage through the mountain pipes and siphons. As it happens, my own reverence for water has always taken the form of this constant meditation upon where the water is, of an obsessive interest not in the politics of water but in the waterworks themselves, in the movement of water through aqueducts and siphons and pumps and forebays and afterbays and wires, weirs, and drains, I'm not really hip on all the water lingo, sorry, in plumbing on the grand scale. I know the data on water projects I will never see. I know that the difficulty Kaiser had closing the last two sluice, I've never seen this word before, sluiceway gates on the Guri Dam in Venezuela. I keep watching on evaporation behind the Aswan in Egypt. I can put myself to sleep imagining the water dropping 1,000 feet into the turbines at Churchill Falls in Labrador. If the Churchill Falls project fails to materialize, I fall back on waterworks closer at hand. The tail race at Hoover on the Colorado, the surge tank in the Tehachapi Mountains that receives the California Aqueduct water pumped higher than water has ever been pumped before, and finally, I replay a morning when I was 17 years old and caught in a military surplus life draft in the construction of the Nimbus Afterbay Dam on the American River near Sacramento. I remember that, at the moment it happened, I was trying to open a tin of anchovies with capers. I recall the raft spinning into the narrow chute through which the river had been temporarily diverted. I recall being deliriously happy. I suppose it was partly the memory of that delirium that led me to visit, one summer morning in Sacramento, the Operations Control Center for the California State Water Project. Actually, so much water is moved around California by so many different agencies that maybe only the movers themselves know on any given day whose water is where, but to get a general picture, it is necessary only to remember that Los Angeles moves some of it, San Francisco moves some of it, the Bureau of Reclamation's Central Valley Project moves some of it, and the California State Water Project moves most of the rest of it, moves a vast amount of it, moves more water farther than has ever been moved anywhere. They collect this water up in the granite keeps of the Sierra Nevada, and they store roughly 1 trillion gallons of it behind the Oroville Dam, and every morning, down at the project's headquarters in Sacramento, they decide how much of their water they want to move the next day. They make this morning decision according to supply and demand, which is simple in theory but rather more complicated in practice. In theory, each of the project's 5 field divisions, the Oroville, the Delta, the San Luis, and the San Joaquin, and the Southern divisions, places a call to the headquarters before 9 a.m. and tells the dispatchers how much water is needed by its local water contractors, who have in turn based their morning estimates on orders from growers and other big users. A schedule is made. The gates open and close according to the schedule. the water flows south, and the deliveries are made. In practice, this requires prodigious coordination, precision, and the best efforts of several human minds and that of a UNIVAC 418. In practice, it might be necessary to hold large flows of water for power production, or to flush out encroaching salinity in the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta, the most ecologically sensitive point on the system. In practice, a sudden rain might obviate the need for a delivery when that delivery is already on its way. In practice, what is being delivered here is an enormous volume of water, not quarts of milk or spools of thread, and it takes 2 days to move such a delivery down the Oroville into the Delta, which is the great pooling place for California water and has been for some years alive with electronic sensors and telemetering equipment and men blocking channels and diverting flows and shoveling fish away from the pumps. It takes perhaps another 6 days to move this same water down the California Aqueduct from the Delta to the Tehachapi and put it over the hill to Southern California. Putting some over the hill is what they say around the Project Operations Control Center when they want to indicate that they are pumping aqueduct water from the floor of the San Joaquin Valley up and over the Tehachapi Mountains. Pulling it down is what they say when they want to indicate that they are lowering a water level somewhere in the system. They can put some over the hill by remote control from this room in Sacramento with its UNIVAC and its big board and its flashing lights. They can pull down a pool in the San Joaquin by remote control from this room in Sacramento with its locked doors and its ringing sensors out there in the water itself. From this room in Sacramento, the whole system takes on the aspect of a perfect $3 billion hydraulic toy, and in certain ways it is. Let's start draining quail at 12 o'clock was the 10:51 a.m. entry on the electronically recorded communications log the day I visited the Operations Control Center. Quail is a reservoir in Los Angeles County with a gross capacity of, I cannot read this number out loud, but it's 16360180000 gallons. That is a lot. Okay, was the response recorded in the log. I knew at that moment that I had missed the only vocation for which I had any instinctive affinity. I wanted to drain quail myself. Not many people I know carry their end of the conversation when I want to talk about water deliveries, even when I stress that these deliveries affect their lives, indirectly, every day. Indirectly is not quite enough for most people I know. This morning, however, several people I know were affected not indirectly, but directly by the way the water moves. They had been in New Mexico shooting a picture, one sequence of which required a river deep enough to sink a truck, the kind with a cab driver and a trailer and 50 or 60 wheels. It so happened that no river near the New Mexico location was running that deep this year. The production was therefore moved today to Needles, California, where the Colorado River normally runs, depending upon releases from Davis Dam, 18 to 25 feet deep. Now, follow this closely. Yesterday we had a freak tropical storm in Southern California, 2 inches of rain in a normally dry mouth, and because of this, rain flooded the fields and provided more irrigation than any grower could possibly want for several days. No water was ordered from Davis Dam. No orders, no releases. Supply and demand. As a result, the Colorado was running only 7 feet deep past Needles today. Sam Peckinpah's desire for 18 feet of water in which to sink a truck not being the kind of demand anyone at Davis Dam is geared to meet. The production closed down for the weekend. Shooting will resume Tuesday, providing some growers order water and the agencies controlling the Colorado release it. Meanwhile, many gaffers, best boys, cameramen, assistant directors, script supervisors, stunt drivers, and maybe even Sam Peckinpah are waiting out the weekend in Needles, where it is often 110 degrees at 5 p.m. and hard to get dinner after 8. This is a California parable, but a true one. I have always wanted a swimming pool, and never had one. When it became generally known a year or so ago that California was suffering a severe drought, many people in water-rich parts of the country seemed obscurely gratified and made frequent reference to Californians having to brick up their swimming pools. In fact, a swimming pool requires, once it has been filled and the filter has begun its process of cleaning and recirculating the water, virtually no water. But the symbolic content of swimming pools has always been interesting. A pool is misapprehended as a trapping of affluence, real or pretended, and of a kind of hedonistic attention to the body. Actually, a pool is, for many of us in the West, a symbol not of affluence but of order. of control over the uncontrollable. A pool is water, made available and useful, and is, as such, infinitely soothing to the Western eye. It is easy to forget that the only natural force over which we have any control out here is water, and that only recently. In my memory, California summers were characterized by the coughing in the pipes that meant the well was dry, and California winters by all-night watches on rivers about to crest, by sandbaggings, by dynamite on the levees and flooding on the first floor. Even now, the place is not all that hospitable to extensive settlement. As I write, a fire has been burning out of control for 2 weeks in the ranges behind the Big Sur coast. Flash floods last night wiped out all major roads into Imperial County. I noticed this morning a hairline crack in a living room tile from last week's earthquake, a 4.4 I never felt. In the part of California where I now live, aridity is the single most prominent feature of the climate, and I am not pleased to see this year cactus spreading wild to the sea. There will be days this winter when the humidity will drop to 10, 7, 4. Tumbleweed will blow against my house and the sound of the rattlesnake will be duplicated 100 times a day by dried bougainvillea drifting in my driveway. The apparent ease of California life is an illusion, and those who believe the illusion is real live here only in the most temporary way. I know, as well as the next person, that there is considerable transcendent value in a river running wild and undammed, a river running free over granite, but I have also lived beneath such a river when it was running in flood, and gone without showers when it was running dry. The West begins, Bernardo Devoto wrote, where the average annual rainfall drops below 20 inches. This is maybe the best definition of the West I have ever read, and it goes a long way towards explaining my own passion for seeing the water under control, but many people I know persist in looking for psychoanalytical implications in this passion. As a matter of fact, I have explored, in an amateur way, the more obvious of these implications and come up with nothing interesting. A certain external reality remains, and resists interpretation. The West begins where the average annual rainfall drops below 20 inches. Water is important to people who do not have it, and the same is true of control. Some 15 years ago, I tore a poem by Carl Shapiro from a magazine and pinned it on my kitchen wall. This fragment of paper is now on the wall of a sixth kitchen and crumbles a little whenever I touch it. But I keep it there for the last stanza, which has for me the power of a prayer. It is raining in California, a straight rain, cleaning the heavy oranges on the bow, filling the gardens till the gardens flow, shining the olives, tiling the gleaming tile, waxing the dark camellia leaves more green, flooding the day-long valleys like the Nile. I thought of those lines almost constantly on the morning in Sacramento when I went to visit the California State Water Project Operations Control Center. If I had wanted to drain quail at 10:51 that morning, I wanted, by early afternoon, to do a great deal more. I wanted to open and close the Clifton Court 4-bay intake gate. I wanted to produce some power down at the San Luis Dam. I wanted to pick a pool at random on the aqueduct and pull it down and then refill it, watching for the hydraulic jump. I wanted to put some water over the hill, and I wanted to shut down all flow from the aqueduct into the Bureau of Reclamation's Cross Valley Canal, just to see how long it would take somebody over at Reclamation to call up and complain. I stayed as long as I could and watched the system work on the big board with the lighted checkpoints. The Delta salinity report was coming in on one of the teletypes behind me. The Delta tidal report was coming in on another. The earthquake board, which had been desensitized to sound its alarm, a beeping tone for Southern California, a high-pitched tone for the North, only for those earthquakes which register at least 3.0 on the Richter scale, was silent. I had no further business in this room, and yet I wanted to stay the day. I wanted to be the one that day who was shining the olives, filling the gardens, and flooding the day-long valleys like the Nile. I want it still. This was in 1977. Thank you so much for tuning in for my story time. I hope that you enjoyed the two stories that I read and tolerated the interjections on my reflections of the fax machine and red light therapy and stuff. Anyways, you've been listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
You've tuned in to Pandemonium, a public affairs program from WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed on this show are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT or Carnegie Mellon University. Email comments or questions to WRCT Public Affairs pa@wrct.org. And now, Pandemonium. An apocalypse is an event on a grand scale, a catastrophe that affects our lives indelibly. It is also a story that, judging from the sheer volume of them that we tell, alone and together, has a definite ending, the details of which we are rather concerned with. What is it about the current day that so often casts our focus onto apocalypse and the events that follow it? Is there a background noise of sublime terror, a raging storm, or news of permanent collapse pervading our lives, driving political conflict, justifying ever greater engineering of social order? And is this disaster specific to us, or has it always been present throughout the ages? In first seeking the center of the apocalypse, I sat down with Ben Knight, a Berlin-based filmmaker, and asked him about the movie he just made.
Okay, so it is called We're All Going to Die, and it is about people who are preparing in one way or another for catastrophe. And it kind of moves through different types of preparation. So it begins with your standard prepper type person who would be like hoarding food and maybe learning new skills and figuring out how to, you know, use radios again rather than cell phones, and you know, just preppers, and then sort of talking about how they their kind of disappointment with the way everyone else is just carrying on their day, and they have to think about all these terrible things that are going to happen. So that's the kind of the beginning of it. Anyway, so I met a couple of preppers, and then it kind of moves into a more climate change, climate grief is a big thing now amongst a lot of people, and it has been for quite a while. And I met a couple of people in the States who went through a profound grief 20 years ago because they felt like this economic and social system was totally unsustainable. And so there was this, he's called Guy McPherson. He went and 20 years ago, he felt like, you know, this isn't going to work. No. And he went and lived on a homestead in New Mexico. He was a tenured professor, and he gave up his job and went and lived on a homestead in New Mexico and learned how to make cheese. And then he realized that there was another thing that meant that even if somehow humans prevented the burning of fossil fuels overheating the earth, because of what he calls the aerosol dimming effect, the pollution would actually shields us from the worst heat of the sun. So even if we reduced pollution, we would be fried too. So he then realized that we're damned if we do and we're damned if we don't, and decided that he couldn't be bothered to live on a homestead anymore, and now he just lives in a normal house and gives interviews and does podcasts and things like that. And he calls himself an educator. I mean, he's like an odd fellow, because he kind of, what was interesting about him for me was because he went through this period of profound despair and grief, and what he thought was that the futility of trying to continue. And then he came out of the other side of it and said, well, look, you know, we're all going to die, so there's nothing anyone else could do about it. So I might as well just live the best life I can the way I want to live and not worry about anything. And that's what he does now. Do I feel that daily life has given over to chaos? No, I feel like what is surprising about the current situation is that everyone is carrying on as normal, to and basically shutting out the chaos as much as they can, and finding ways to distract each other. I mean, there's always like an initial shock moment, as it happened when, especially if you live in Europe, when Russia just invaded Ukraine, for example. But then after a few days, and, you know, we have like thousands, hundreds of thousands of refugees, you started noticing that people were posting their Wordle scores on Twitter again, which they had been doing, you know, quite regularly up until that moment. And then there was about a week where people stopped doing it, and then they kind of put them back. So I think there's a natural human tendency to avoid chaos at all costs. If people get used to things, don't they? People get, it's surprising how quickly people get used to disaster scenarios and learn to cope. I mean, I was reading, I mean, just to get back to the same example again, but I was reading reports now of people in Kiev and how, you know, they want to open the schools again in Kiev tomorrow. They want to do online schooling again. Which is like crazy when you think about, you know, that the Russian army is 20, 25 kilometers away from the city center still. Well, first thing was that someone told me that they were going to go to Mexico anyway. And I thought, oh, that would be cool to go to Mexico. And then I thought, and then I remembered that in Mexico, it's the site of the center of the Chicxulub crater, which is the crater that was caused by the asteroid that killed all the dinosaurs 66 million years ago. And I kind of thought it would be, you know, what better place to sort of conclude the film, but at the site of a catastrophe that almost wiped out all life on Earth. And one of the five great big mass extinction events that have happened, the last one that has happened throughout in our history. And so I had this sort of vision of filming at this, because I knew there was a little monument there. There's a little memorial to the dinosaurs in this town, and it's a town on the northern coast of Yucatan, on the Yucatan, in the Yucatan Peninsula, a sort of coastal town. But the crater itself is 100 miles across, so you obviously can't see it, and it is also about a kilometer underground. And they only really found out that it was there in the 1980s. And I just thought I'd, but then when they did find it, the little town, and it's a kind of like a, there's nothing really in the town. It's like a beach resort, but not a particularly fancy one. There are no big hotels there, but they do have a little monument to the dinosaurs, which I thought was quite poignant. So I wanted to film there, and so I did a little thing where I stood next to the monument and spoke to the camera about my feelings about why I wanted to film a scene there, and why, you know, why I saw that point as a kind of the starting point for the film, even though it was right at the end of filming. So that was one reason. Oh, the other thing was that there's a lot of Mayan people still around there, and people often think of the Mayan civilization as a civilization that collapsed. So I was quite interested in that too. So I interviewed a few Mayan people. I mean, most of the people in that region are still have Mayan heritage. So that was pretty interesting. And rather than a cycle, I would think of it as concentric circles that we're always kind of living in a space that has been created by a past disaster, that we are never really, the destruction of all the dinosaurs was what was the event that made our evolution possible. You know, I mean, it's getting a bit like, obviously a bit esoteric now, but the idea is that we're always living in the aftermath of another disaster, and that disaster is what made our lives even possible. So I wanted kind of the end of the film, I want people to kind of make peace with the idea of apocalypse, make peace with the idea of collapse, and destruction, because after all, our own lives depend on someone else's apocalypse and other creatures' extinction, you know. And so I kind of like I see it as sort of, yeah, like we're always in a way our whole we're always inside the crater of an asteroid that crushed the people that came before us, or the dinosaurs that came before us. A lot of people feel very a lot of anxiety at the moment, and especially now because of the war, but also because of a lot of people feel a lot of anxiety about climate change, and a lot of people feel general anxiety about, you know, pandemics. People just worry about the future. It's part of our nature to worry about the future, and people want to feel safe, and none of us really are ever safe, and something like the threat of nuclear war kind of really brings that home, you know. I meet an Indian author who's written quite a lot about climate change called Amitav Ghosh, and then he kind of says, well, what's interesting for me about all this is that it's not like I don't worry about the future either, because for my part of the world, he comes from Bangladesh and India, and people from the colonized parts of the world, they've already been through their own destructive apocalypse, and now they're still alive, you know, and they still survive and they still thrive in many ways. And he says what he sees is basically this anxiety about the future is a kind of is just like our part of the world, the Western part of the world, realizing that it is losing its power. You know, like apparently in grief, like when psychologists talk about grief, there's a thing where if you've got a parent or a grandparent who is dying, and you know that they're going to die, people start to grieve in advance, you know, or especially if they have dementia, you can see them like their faculties shutting down one by one, and people who are watching their loved ones die like that, they go through this kind of pre-grief. And there are these therapists and psychoanalysts and psychologists who say that this is what a lot of people are feeling now about the earth itself, or about the society itself. They're feeling they're going through this kind of pre-grief for something that is dying. Yeah, there's a nostalgia. There's a loss. We've lost our innocence, and in a weird way, they kind of want the apocalypse to happen so that we regain that innocence. You know, it's a very Christian thing, isn't it? It's like we gave up paradise, so now we have to somehow get back to it through a major disaster. And that would be like a purge. It would be like Noah's flood, and then we would get back to our lost innocence. I think a lot of people would say that but probably that's not how it'll pan out, because as you say, we will have certain technologies that we could probably still use for a while anyway. I mean, yeah, depends how long your generator's going to run. I mean, a lot of the preppers that I know are actually, even though they don't believe in climate change, or the ones that I met didn't, they actually hate the Green Party and the Green movement in general, they actually are quite ecologically better prepared than most people, because they have invested in solar panels, because they do think that the power grid is not sustainable. So they have invested in having in like local solar panels, which is this one guy I know in, I'm thinking of this guy I know in Cologne, who's extremely skeptical of the climate movement, but he is autonomous from the power grid. Mm-hmm. I think it would be like the idea that hope is treacherous. I think a lot of these people look at the way that normal people, I say normal people, but everyone is feels like that we have to, basically we everyone is like hoping that, you know, like Putin doesn't launch his nuclear weapons, or hoping that we prevent the worst excesses of climate change, or hoping that that you know, society won't collapse and that we'll find some way, we'll keep it together in one way or another. And they see this hope as a delusional thing. And he said, and one guy, Guy McPherson, in fact, he said, I said to him, but surely because he wrote in one of his books, he wrote like, we should give up hope. Like, hope is this treacherous thing. And I said, but surely the opposite of hope is despair, you know, surely. And he goes, no, he was like, he would have slapped his thigh if he could have done, but he was like, no, it's not the, why are you saying that? You know, that's not true at all. And then I said, okay, so what is the opposite of hope? And he said, I say the opposite of hope is taking action, is a sort of taking responsibility for your life, or trying to change something. If you really, really do worry about these things, if you are extremely anxious about the future, then hope isn't going to help you. What's going to help you is figuring out how you are going to deal with it and facing it. And I suppose that's what stuck with me, was this sort of this, and that can be practical. It can be like, you know, do what a prepper does and find a bunker in the forest and fill it with food, or it can be, you know, joining a climate protest or something. It can be like whatever you do. It can, or it can just be facing up to this, your general anxiety, and figuring out, okay, because we are all going to die. So what are you going to do with the time you have left? You know, what is valuable to you? And I think that is sort of the profound thing, is that you know, we should like this idea that. Yeah, this idea that it will all be okay in the end, is a treacherous idea, and in fact, it should be okay now. And all you can really control is this is how you cope with your life. What we're facing is, everybody goes, oh, we're all going to die. Yeah. But then we are all going to die. Like, that's the one immutable fact of human existence, is that it will end, you know. And fully realizing that is, I think it's an Achilles in Homer. Doesn't he say everything is more beautiful because we're doomed, and the gods envy us for our mortality, you know, like, didn't he say something like that? So sure. I think the idea of it is that, you know, we can, everything is more beautiful because we're all going to die, you know, because of our mortality, and the gods envy us, the immortal gods envy us because of that. So I guess it's, so what I'm saying is that this sort of fear of the apocalypse is actually just a facing up to the sort of the human condition, in a very normal way, because, you know, yeah.
A man who has made a more specific, a metaphysical study of apocalypse, through how life should be lived at all times and in all places, is Orthodox rabbinical figure Chad Whitaker of Pittsburgh. I put him to the question in a dark cavern.
People are constantly bringing some sort of post-apocalyptic scenario to bear to, as like an exercise in like some sort of existential threat. And, okay. And perhaps the closer we get to feeling that there's some sort of accelerando in our lifetimes, and it was wars in the past, and now obviously what we're looking at is...
Yeah, more wars, even like heightened. It is a crescendo. Maybe, but here's the thing. All right, so fundamentally, I don't know, right? Like, fundamentally, I don't know. Right. Like, logically, I can picture some scenarios. It's like, I can imagine an existential threat materializing. Like, I can imagine more easily now than last month, right? Like, a nuclear holocaust materializing, right? Or I can imagine an existential threat not materializing and universal paperclips and, like, you know, humanity expanding out into the galaxy or whatever, right? Like, you know, I can imagine Isaac Asimov, last story, sort of like cyclic, like, you know, the boom and bust and the, like, the on universal scales and, like, all of this, right? Like, anything logically imaginable is imaginable, okay? And God's outside of all of it, and God's doing whatever he wants, and there's these fundamental patterns of ordering, of hierarchy, of structure, you know, of structures of beauty, of these abstractions, of these hierarchical structures, like those are kind of circling back around to like this little apocalypse. Like, I really only need to care about what's in front of me. What's, like, what's in my sphere of influence, you know? Well, how about everything else? It's like, well, I don't know. I'm not everything else. Right. Like, I'm me, right. You know? Like, here's what I have to deal with right in front of me.
In terms of that existential threat, though, I think we're always presented with some extraordinarily grim, dark, bleak, like The Road, or Nathan was talking about The Stand earlier.
Yeah, right.
And I guess just like, what do we do in the face of that? What do we do, you know, rationally with a study of history, with a study of, you know, you have this theological framework.
But man, we had apocalypse in the last century. Like, look at Russia last century, you know? Like, look at the utter upheaval of mm-hmm. civilization and, like, you know, the Communist Revolution and Stalin. And yeah. The gulag, and like,
yeah,
you know, which is like reverberating through to our present day, right? Like this, like these tumultuous, yeah, you know, or the, like, the Polish Jew, right? Like the, like, Holocaust, like they're, like, we witnessed in the 20th century, you know, almost as much apocalypse as one could want, let's say, you know, short of an existential crisis, short of an existential threat materializing. It's like these were, and then, but then what do individual people do in these, right? Like, there's a book called Father Arseny, there's a biography of this priest named Father Arseny, you know, who was an amazing saint in the gulag, and, like, kept the flame alive, you know? Like, it was, like, a real life... Well, you referenced The Road, right? And, like that's fiction, okay? Like, keeping the light alive. Like, gotta keep the light alive. Like, this guy kept the light alive in the gulag for decades, you know? Like... like, when you're a person, you know? Like,
right.
When you're a person, like, he had... He couldn't... He wasn't in control of the sweep of history, you know. He was a grain of sand in the ground in the wheels of history, right? And what? And he he did well with what he had, you know, and like what more could any of us hope to do than to do well with what's God has given us in our sphere of influence, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, raise your son as well as you can. Love your neighbors as well as you can. Like, I don't want to do it out of fear. If I'm going to prepare for an apocalypse, like, there's, like, the apocalypse choosing not to try to love God with all my heart, mind, soul, and strength. And I tasted choosing not to try, and that is what terrifies me. That's what terrifies me.
I'm telling myself the story of my life, Stranger and Song of Fiction. We start with the joyful mysteries before the appearance of ether, trying to capture the elusive. The farm where the crippled horses heal, the woods where autumn is reversed, and the longing for bliss in the arms of some beloved from the past. I said, "Your daddy loves you." I said, "Your daddy loves you very much. He just doesn't want to live with us anymore."
You've been listening to Pandemonium. The opinions expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT or Carnegie Mellon University. Email comments or questions to WRCT Public Affairs, pa@wrct.org. Thanks for listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
It's a time of tremendous uncertainty for everyone, but some things haven't changed. Stomach cancer is still a leading cause of cancer death worldwide. More than 1 million people will be diagnosed this year alone, and it's vital to know your risks and learn ways to prevent it. It's also critical for cancer patients to protect themselves from all viruses. No Stomach for Cancer encourages you to listen to medical experts to understand your risks. Find out more about COVID-19 at cancer.gov and learn more about your risks for stomach cancer at nostomachforcancer.org.
It is now just past the hour here on 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh. My name is Paul. This is a show called Viva La Mock. We are midway through said Viva La Mock goodness. And at that halfway point, know what we do? We stop and we smell the roses. And we check out what's going on around town with a WRCT radio and a music calendar. That's what we do. Take a look at the WRCT radio calendar. Let you know some things going on around town. Culturally. For example, Jaunt. Are you familiar with Jaunt? It's actually a safe exploration of public art throughout the city of Pittsburgh. The Office of Public Art is actually pleased to announce Jaunt. It's an artist-designed public art tour by D.S. Kinzel, who's the co-founder of Boom Concepts in Garfield. Now, Jaunt features a series of postcards by Pittsburgh artists available at various locations that provides a safe exploration of public art during the pandemic. Now, the postcards, here's some of those places for that safe exploration. You can find these postcards at Boom Concepts, such a tough word to say, which is right there on Penn Avenue in Garfield, or at the Small Mall in Lawrenceville, or a couple places in Wilkinsburg, like the CDCP Project Space, and there is a Small Mall outpost there, or right across the street from Boom Concepts, while you're there, People's Grocery, Garfield, Penn Avenue. So, that's something for you to do. You could also support Thrifty, which is the East End Community Thrift Store. It's located also on Penn Avenue in Garfield. Due to COVID-19 pandemic, masks are required if you go to the thrift store, but it's one door down from the Thomas Merton Center. and all profits from the store are donated to the Thomas Merton Center to help fund their general explorations. What are they looking for? Well, they're looking for clothing and furniture and household items, donations, volunteers, and shoppers like you. For more information, 412-361-6010. And then finally, don't forget about Off-Route Art. It connects artists and people, right? But they connect the public with original art made by artists 16 to 24 years old. For more information, offrootart.com is where you'll find things like that. If you have an event you want to include on this calendar, something that the kids can do, something that you can do, something your parents can do, I don't care, something to do, send us an email at radio-calendar@wrct.org. Take a turn to the WRCT music calendar, let you know some things that are happening. There are things happening. Now, as you know, most things aren't happening due to the pandemic and crowd sizes and the virus and just everything. So what I urge you to do is go to your favorite venue websites. Go to your favorite promoter websites. Go to your favorite cultural items like TrustArts.org or CalliopeHouse.org or some of those, and just check out what they've got going on, because a lot of them have Pittsburgh Symphony, another great example. They have live streaming concerts and things that you can attend virtually and you know, just help support the arts during this time. I'm going to tell you a couple of shows I do know that are coming up. Let's see. I do know. Oh, yeah, Valentine's Day. How about on Valentine's Day at 7:30 p.m., the Pittsburgh Festival Opera is presenting One Enchanted Evening, a special Valentine's Day concert online. PittsburghFestivalOpera.org for more information on that. On Tuesday the 23rd at 7 p.m., the Off Minor Jazz Series is going to be celebrating McCoy Tyner, who passed away almost a year ago. That's going to be at alphabetcity.org. Thursday the 4th, the August Wilson Center is presenting Lindsay Morgan Smith. Information can be found at awc.culturaldistrict.org. See, those are some things happening. If you have an event that you'd like people to know about,